From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
58 people were killed in the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. We will try to make sense of this tragedy and discuss what the government can do to respond to it. President Trump visited hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico, but was it too little too late? And the Secretary of State won't deny that he called the president a moron. Will foreign leaders believe him when he claims to speak for that alleged moron? Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, Republican pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson will join us to discuss Trump's approach to culture war politics. Is he forcing liberals to defend unpopular ideas, or is he just making liberal ideas more popular? And private jet travel got one cabinet secretary fired and is flummoxing several others. Why is this the one scandal that seems to stick? All that's up ahead. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, professor at the University of Texas, fellow at the Center for Politics and Governance at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, and contributor to MSNBC and NBC News. And our special guest is Juliette Kayyem. She's a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School and former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. The shooting late Sunday night on the Las Vegas Strip was not the deadliest mass shooting in American history. There were several racially motivated mass shootings in the decades after the Civil War targeting African Americans that had greater death tolls. But it was the deadliest mass shooting in the United States in approximately 100 years. Americans have been horrified by the casualties, 58 dead and hundreds injured, and unnerved by the shooter's meticulous planning and novel approach, shooting at a crowd from more than 1,000 feet away, 32 stories up in the Mandalay Bay Hotel Tower, at a rate that sure sounded like he was using fully automatic weapons. And we have been stumped by the apparent lack of evidence emerging about the shooter's motive. Juliette, how should we start to understand an attack like this?
It's very hard to do at this stage. I'm just being brutally honest. I should be able to analyze better. By now, 5 days later, you would have at least eliminated a number of theories of the case. And unfortunately, with no theory of the case, we essentially are stuck with a lot of innuendo and questioning about who he is and whether he had co-conspirators in this activity. I'm less interested in motivation right now, as also, though, in his methods. You opened up the opening correctly by saying essentially it sounded like an automatic weapon. It is an automatic weapon. I mean, the way that he transformed at least 13 of his guns with this bump stock device, which not only changes the experience for the shooter, but obviously the impact that it has on those that he is shooting at, the capacity to shoot that many people, is not defended. The existence of the devices can't be defended by any straight-faced test at this stage. It just can't. So I'm hopeful out of this week that what we couldn't do after Columbine, what we couldn't do after Sandy Hook, we might be able to do with one particular device, which is you should just ban it. It does not need to be regulated. It needs to be banned.
Let me take a step back and explain what a bump stock is. So first of all, a semi-automatic gun is a gun where you pull the trigger, it fires a round, and then it automatically chambers another round so that you can pull the trigger and fire again. And about half of all the guns that are sold in the United States now are semi-automatic, including the typical handguns that police officers carry. A fully automatic gun is one where you hold the trigger down and it just sprays bullets out. And these are, they're not quite illegal, but they're very heavily restricted. They have been for about 80 years. And crimes committed with fully automatic guns are extremely rare, in large part because the government has effectively controlled the distribution of them. This device that the shooter had, a bump stock, was something, it basically, you attach it to the back of the gun, and it allows you to fire by pulling forward with your non-shooting hand so that when you get off a round, the gun sort of bounces back to you and then forward again, and it bumps your finger against the trigger. So technically, the gun isn't automatic. You have to depress the trigger every time it fires, but it allows you to fire drastically faster than you ordinarily could with a semi-automatic weapon, and it made the attack deadlier. And so, Rich, one thing that has made this different from other mass shootings in terms of political implications is you've seen both Republicans and Democrats looking at this and saying, well, why is this device legal? Should we prohibit it? And it looks like some motion may actually be made in Washington to do that.
Yeah, it's actually rare to have a gun control proposal that has a nexus with one of these mass shootings, and this is one that does. He would have had a much harder time perpetrating the carnage he did if he didn't have multiple versions of this device. So these haven't been used in prior mass shootings, in part because they make your gunfire much more inaccurate, but no one had contemplated this sort of scenario where you can set up a tripod and just spray bullets into a crowd of thousands of innocent people. So this is something where you may see some movement. The NRA has very notably come out in favor of more regulation. That's a little bit of an ambiguous statement. I think the ATF is actually correct in its interpretation that under current law, these devices are legal, which means that Congress should go and make them illegal. And a sensible bipartisan deal in my mind would be to restrict bump stocks. At the same time, you liberalize the availability of so-called silencers or suppressors that really don't represent any additional threat to anyone, and that if you actually have them, could save the hearing of law-abiding gun users.
Vicky, what do you think? Is this an opportunity for some bipartisanship?
I think we need to read between the lines. So Rich pointed out that the NRA came out and said, let's look at the bump stock issue. Let's actually review it. Usually we see the NRA keeping silent and standing in the background. But what they're calling for is not an amendment to a law or a new law. They're saying, let's review this. Let's put it through the regulatory process. So what that means in boring speak is it's going to take a long time to go through the rules process, the administrative process, outside of the public view, and give a little bit of time for the public to cool its heels. So when everybody was excited about the NRA coming out and moving toward some type of gun regulation, I say, read very carefully what they put forward. And I think that this gives Republican lawmakers cover in saying, well, we don't really want to grapple with this in Congress right now because we're going to review it administratively. Let's not forget that the primaries are just a couple of weeks away, and the gun issue is a very big issue with the Republican primary electorate, and that keeps Republican lawmakers very nervous. So I think that it's not as clear-cut as we may think just by seeing this announcement, this reversal of the NRA breaking its silence.
What Vicky's describing there makes sense to me as what the NRA is trying to do here. But do you think that's going to work? You've seen a number of Republican members of Congress already calling for legislation here. If the NRA says, no, wait, let's do this regulatory process and see if that can work, do they actually have the clout to insist on that?
I read the political effect of the NRA statement as a flashing green light. I mean, it's just so extraordinary that to say, okay, let's further regulate anything. And it opens up the argument that I just said, that if you read the law, automatic weapons are when you suppress the trigger once and get automatic fire. The bump stock doesn't technically do that, as you ably described earlier, Josh. You're still suppressing the trigger multiple times to get the multiple gunshots. You're just doing it extremely rapidly. So you can ask the ATF to do this, and the correct answer from the ATF, maybe be under political pressure to come up with something different, would be, no, we're just interpreting the law.
In fact, that is the answer the ATF gave in 2010. These devices are not very old, and it came up during the Obama administration. The ATF decided they didn't have the legal authority to prohibit them.
Right.
Juliet, you had something to say?
So I think this may be different. I don't trust the NRA. I think they're very sophisticated political players. But I think this ties into the motivation question, the likelihood that we may get some resolution on, you know, some devices here. And the reason why is this motivation question can't be answered right now. I mean, in other words, if he had been ISIS, the focus would have been on that issue and radicalization and violent extremism and whatever you want to call it. I have no doubt that the impact of Arab and Muslims in America would have been felt because the Trump administration would have likely responded very differently than it does now, or that there's some evidence of some sociopathic disorder that could have been like, well, why did he get guns in the first place? Here we have someone whose motivation we can't figure out, who's lawfully getting access to both guns and the devices that alter the guns, and who is a gambler and sort of out there in the world and doing things. I mean, I know he was a private guy, but it's not like people didn't see him for the last 10 years. And so in some ways, the fact that anyone could do this, right, there's no explanation, anyhow, right, like, you know, from a hotel room or anywhere shooting into a proverbial fishbowl, maybe that means that we might accept that you know, we can't just play defense all the time, that we actually have to play offense and start going after these weapons of mass casualty that are having, you know, these kind of death rates throughout our society. And because we're never going to solve the motivation or the means or, you know, the place, and we need to now look at the access issue.
Go ahead, Vicky.
Well, I was going to say, I am the resident Texan here, and I was born and raised in Arizona, which is an open carry state. I live in Texas, and while I couldn't agree more with Juliet about the lack of a motivation could be a rallying point, there's this deep cultural factor of guns, of gun culture. I would like nothing more in this world than to be wrong, than for Congress to actually come together and pass something. But you know, when you live day in and day out with folks who feel very passionately about this, you see on the ground why it's not going to go anywhere. So once the public outrage simmers down after the next couple of months, we're going to go back to normal, because a lot of this has to do with how we are districted. And Steve Israel wrote a great op-ed in the New York Times that points that out, that the partisanship, the hyper-partisanship within our country is rooted at the grassroots level because of our districts, and that filters up. So I think unless we see some massive institutional change, we're going to see a lot of the same.
That's Steve Israel, a Democratic member of Congress from New York. Juliet, I wanted to ask you about, you know, aside from gun policy, are there other security policy implications of this shooting? Is there anything that either the government or hotels or people who are planning music festivals, lessons to be taken away about strengthening security here?
So we're thinking about it already. Those, you know, I'm on the email list, and the listserv is talking about the lessons learned. We have to do that. If there's any silver lining to an event like this, it's got to be that we're going to do better next time. So the short-term ones that people are obviously thinking about is greater surveillance at hotels, in particular ones that might be, you know, in areas where a big event is happening. I think it's very plausible that he got guns into the room and no one noticed. I've been to Las Vegas a lot. I go to big hotels a lot. You could do it. You put them in your car. You come up four or five different times with different suitcases. But, you know, there might be some surveillance that you could imagine, though, on the hotel side that would stop this from happening. I also think, though, on the response side, what we have to learn is that the entrances have to be faster as exits in an event like this. And I think what you're starting to see is the sort of response might have been stymied a little bit by the inability of people to get out of that fishbowl, and communications and all the things that you want to happen fast, because the measure of success sometimes is, you know, 55 people didn't die, but only, this is horrible to say, but only 10. So there's a lot of lessons learned right now. But let me tell you, I'm hardly fatalistic, but the scenarios by which bad people can do bad things are limitless. And so we need to start thinking about how are they doing those bad things. I think that's why this gun debate is out there.
Yeah, it's much easier, though, to say we need to do something about guns than it is to outline what specifically you would do about guns that would prevent horrible crimes like this one. I mean, sort of the next step up the relatively minor policy proposal is universal background checks. All these shooters almost always pass universal background checks, the already existing background checks, because they don't have criminal records and they have been adjudicated for mental illness. Then you can go the assault weapons ban. The assault weapons ban has been acknowledged even by some gun control advocates. It just has to do with the cosmetic features of a weapon. It doesn't have to do with its firing mechanism or its power. So then you have to go the next step, which is really doing something about semi-automatic weapons, which are a huge swath of the guns in the country, because they're just basically modern weapons. And then you're really running afoul of the Second Amendment. And then you're getting to what Brett Stevens in the New York Times argued this week, which is Democrats, if they really want to do something about this, need to advocate for repealing the Second Amendment. One, never going to happen. Even if it did happen, and if you got this, you know, far down the road, you would see the most enormous increase in the stock of weapons in the United States of America ever. I mean, there are 200, 300, 400 million guns in the United States in circulation now. If there's some real prospect of the Second Amendment being repealed, there would be another 100 million. And then how are you going to do it? Are you going to go and confiscate those? house by house. So unfortunately, the gun control, solution to this is just a fantasy.
I understand your point, but maybe the standard is let's focus on the capacity of bad people to kill lots of people quickly. Like, in other words, I understand the Second Amendment debate, but if you can look at that pool, because in the security world, your measure of success would be if fewer people had died. So I don't doubt that you're going to get the death rate by guns to zero. But I would like to not have it be it of over 50 in less than however long he was shooting for. That's one way to at least focus the political efforts.
After bump stocks, what's the measure that would do that?
Well, so I think
bump stocks is one of them, because I have no doubt that a bar has been crossed now. This is what scares me, that you rarely see violent behavior retracting. And so I think the time is ripe for this.
I feel like there's something a little odd about the way we discuss incremental gun measures versus other incremental laws, because, I mean, the point that it won't prevent all or even most or even a large fraction of gun deaths is not necessarily an argument against a policy. And I think, you know, like, if we're thinking about things to improve public health and, you know, you put better warning labels on cigarettes, and no, it's not going to stop everyone from smoking. But that's not an argument against the policy. It's one thing that improves at the margin, and you can do a lot of little things to make the country a little bit better. And, you know, what Juliet said about better paths of egress from festivals, you could come up with a large number of small recommendations that would make attacks a little bit less deadly. It wouldn't stop anyone from ever doing anything like this again.
What would they be? I mean, besides better methods of egress and bump stocks.
I don't have a lot on gun control out of this other than the bump stock ban, but I think it's a place to start. Unfortunately, we are over time on this topic. I'm going to need to take a break. Up ahead, the president's trip to Puerto Rico. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the left is Vicky DeFrancesco Soto, professor at the University of Texas. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And our special guest is Juliet Kayyem, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump traveled to Puerto Rico amid criticism that he's been at turns inattentive and hostile toward the island in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. He toured damage in Guaynabo, a relatively affluent suburb where the mayor has been a lot nicer to him than the mayor of San Juan. Trump was Trump. He threw paper towels into a crowd. He remarked that the need to help Puerto Rico recover was really throwing the budget out of whack. And then 12 hours later, he told Geraldo Rivera that the island's substantial debts would need to be wiped away, even if that upset Goldman Sachs. Trump's budget director later said not to take the president too literally about debt relief. Vicky, did the president make things better with this trip?
No, he didn't. To start, it was too little, too late. And this comes into a bigger picture of the relationship that Trump has had with Latinos. I mean, to be honest, it's not been a good relationship. Remember how he launched his campaign in 2015 attacking Mexicans. So I think a lot of us in the Latino community are seeing this as another example. But what we can't forget is what the electoral implication of this can be. So Puerto Rico is a commonwealth, but you do have the citizens of Puerto Rico who, if on the mainland, can vote. And I am seeing estimates, Josh, of up to 1 million people leaving the island. Keep in mind that the island's population is only about 3 million. But because of the devastating effects of Maria, we're probably going to see anywhere from about 500,000 to 1 million Puerto Ricans coming to the United States. And where are they going to end up? They're going to end up in Florida. They're going to end up in Philadelphia. They're going to end up in New York, and they are going to have a substantial impact in the 2018 election and then in the 2020 election. So President Trump needs to think about the long view of this, that yes, they may seem distant on the island, but they do have a very tangible voice when they're on the mainland.
I've been hearing this talking point a lot from Democrats. Isn't there something a little bit unseemly about it? It almost feels like talking about the people of Puerto Rico as political instruments.
Well, let's talk about it in historical terms. So in the 1950s, when we first saw the mass migration of Puerto Ricans to New York, it was as a result of failures of Operation Bootstrap, which was tried to ignite the industrial revolution in Puerto Rico, but it ended up displacing a ton of peasants. So they came to New York. And then in the early 2000s, we saw again some economic factors. A tax exemption had been phased out. And so close to half a million Puerto Ricans coming to the mainland. So this is just part of a larger pattern. So when times are tough in Puerto Rico economically, because they are so linked to the United States and also have that citizenship link, they come. And, you know, maybe it's the political scientist in me, but what is the political implication of that? They're going to make their voice heard, unlike other populations who may not be able to have their voice heard at the ballot box.
Rich, what do you think about the this week in Trump in Puerto Rico?
Well, you know, he has a great talent for being a booster and being boosterish. So in Las Vegas, where was there at events at the hospital and with the police, just making the case that they were, you know, terrifically brave and effective in their response, it's great. But then when he goes to Puerto Rico and he's boosting something that doesn't deserve to the boosterist response, it's off key. And two, whenever he's criticized, he's extremely defensive. So since there's been high profile criticism of his response to Puerto Rico, he's defensive and wants to overwhelmingly hit his critics over anything else. And that's what he did on the ground. He didn't particularly help himself. The polling on the approval of his response to Puerto Rico hasn't been good. But I've been a little surprised this hasn't had the resonance I would have thought. And I think it's in part because of hurricane fatigue that we talked about last week, in part because it's a territory and not a state, and in part because even though that the conditions there are dire, as Trump pointed out inappropriately in the context, but truly, you know, the death toll from Katrina was much, much higher.
Vicky, what do you make about that? We've seen a number of these polling numbers about how many Americans don't even know that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. Do you think this is resonating less on the mainland because people don't feel the same connection with Puerto Rico that they felt, say, with New Orleans?
Absolutely. So I think that the poll you're talking about is right. About half of Americans didn't know that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. So I think that that is one of the core aspects. And let's add in the hurricane fatigue on top of that, and maybe even the fatigue of the Puerto Rico obligations for those who may know that Puerto Ricans are citizens, but how the U.S. has had to get involved with the debt relief situation in Puerto Rico. So there are a number of factors here that are making Puerto Ricans feel that they are the redheaded stepchild of the United States. And last year, there was a referendum to see if Puerto Rico could become the 51st state. Very low turnout, but overwhelmingly, Puerto Ricans said, we want to become the 51st state. So I think that we're going to see this pressure continue. And maybe with that, we're going to get a little bit more of a presence of Puerto Rico in mainstream American news.
Juliet, if we set aside the president's sort of rhetorical missteps, in the about 2 weeks since this storm, do you see resources the federal government should have been bringing to bear that it wasn't? Have there been problems in the response, or is the administration really doing the best it can, even if it's not talking about it in the best way that it could?
So I would say no short term and give the government some kudos now. But operationally, it has not been successful because of how long it took for the government to realize the situation it was in and to actually get situational awareness out of Puerto Rico. That shouldn't be happening in this day and age. First of all, 5 days before the hurricane hit, everyone knew it was a bullseye for Puerto Rico. That's when you surge resources, you position them, and you get them ready. So this idea that because Puerto Rico is an island, you know, it's harder is ridiculous. Our operational planning always knew Puerto Rico was an island, right? FEMA has always known Puerto Rico is an island. And what they do is their planning does assume, right, that you're going to drive resources very quickly to stabilize the territory and then move things fast. The challenge in any disaster is the last mile. We can get lots of stuff moving very fast to a warehouse or repository. It's that last mile. And the fact that it seemed to have fallen apart for at least 8 or 9 days is just not acceptable. acceptable in this day and age. It's just there's been too many lessons learned. There's been too many investments in it. And I have to assume that it is either sort of just their own failure to recognize what is happening. Maybe part of it is, well, it's a territory. But it, you know, part of it is just the leadership from the top. This is where you can't just, you know, say Trump is Trump. You know, the immediacy comes from the top, right? If Trump is asking the questions, where's our Navy? Where's the Coast Guard? Where is the last mile being delivered? He would have gotten results. I have no doubt about it. And then finally, on this last point about the fatality rates, I totally agree with Rich that the is a strong measure. I just caution here, you know, the coroners have not been open and you can't get official numbers until the coroners validate them. And so while we are pleased, let's say, in that weird measure of the low number, I am bracing myself because I just can't believe that the number is that low. And so that may be something that Trump may have to reconsider as well in terms of the casualties.
I want to talk about something that happened on Wednesday, which was that Rex Tillerson gave one of the odder press conferences that I've ever seen a cabinet secretary give, responding to a Politico report that he had threatened to resign and that he had called the president a moron in a meeting with other Trump administration officials. Tillerson didn't quite deny the report. He said he'd never considered resigning, which is a claim about his own state of mind. It is not the same thing as never having threatened to resign. And when he was asked whether he'd ever called the president a moron, he deflected, saying he wouldn't get into petty stuff like that. Rich, you wrote a column this week saying Tillerson has to go. Why?
Well, first of all, I mean, this was a press conference that was lawyerly at best, but certainly dishonest in spirit. The idea that he'd never considered this seems completely ridiculous. And you have to give him some credit for not denying that he said Trump was a moron. The State Department spokeswoman went out and eventually denied that. But look, I mean, certainly, if not every cabinet member has called audibly Trump a moron, certainly a lot of them have thought it. But to say it in a setting where it's likely to be repeated if people are irritated at you or want to undercut you is a really bad idea. And the Secretary of State, you know, you have a number of constituencies, the first of which is the president. And signs are he tried to develop a relationship with the president from the beginning, but for whatever reason, it didn't work. He is not well-liked in the building, so-called. He has he's alienated the Foreign Service, no relationship with the foreign policy establishment, no relationship with Congress to speak of, and not well-liked with the media. And he's not even the foremost spokesman for U.S. foreign policy. So I really think if he disappeared tomorrow, most people just wouldn't notice. And he hasn't hired anyone there really to speak of, except for a very tight inner circle. So he has a very tough job, but he hasn't handled it very well. And yes, Trump's instincts, they need to be refined, they need to be channeled, but it can only create incoherence to have someone who's totally out of sympathy with his worldview and foreign policy goals.
Yeah, Vicky, this is the thing that I find remarkable about Rex Tillerson. It's like, who are you and why are you here? As Rich describes, he has no constituency at all.
Why are you at this party, essentially, when you see that person in the corner? So I guess I'm supposed to be against Rich because I'm on the left, but I really enjoyed his article. I like the fact that he went through all the different constituents and says he has no one there. But one thing I do want to add on to this is he's up against a president who conducts his foreign policy via Twitter. So even if he did have a set of allies either in the media or in Foggy Bottom, how can you battle against your head of state who is out there engaging directly with countries via Twitter? So I think that is going to be a challenge for whoever succeeds him. And I know the chatter is now about Nikki Haley and whether she would be the right next successor. But any person who steps into this position will have a very challenging course. And they're going to ultimately have to decide whether they just alienate the president, maybe not call him a moron, but entrench themselves in Foggy Bottom and try to trudge forward that way.
Juliet, in terms of Trump's Twitter diplomacy, one way that played out over the last few days was Trump publicly breaking with Rex Tillerson over North Korea on Twitter. Tillerson had made comments to the effect that we were talking with the North Koreans, and Trump was upset about this, so he tweeted that Rex is wasting his time by talking with the North Koreans. And it just makes me wonder how other countries, including North Korea, parse what we're doing? How do they interpret those mixed signals that they get from the president and the secretary of state who are in a public fight with each other?
So it's pretty clear now that Trump has sort of made himself somewhat irrelevant from their perspective. I mean, in other words, he does that with a tweet. Do they really think that that's a policy? No. And so what you're starting to see, the longer term shifts that a lot of us worried about when Trump became president, is alliances forming elsewhere, in particular towards China. And I'm no huge fan of Saudi Arabia, but we should be paying attention to their sort of growing dislike of us. And obviously, the Europeans are not so happy. And so, look, these orientations will go elsewhere. That may make some people happy. I still live in a world in which I think the U.S. is relevant. We obviously are in terms of our weapons, but that we also represent something that other countries should want to emulate. So, I mean, Trump is just these tweets. It's like there's no explanation anymore. I mean, he's, made himself just a laughingstock. You don't need to interpret the tweets. He can't pick up the phone and call Tillerson. He has to, tell everyone. And, we're talking now after his famous statement last night in front of the military families, where he says this is the quiet before the storm. And a reporter asks us, what storm? And he says, you just wait and see. I mean, who takes the responsibility they have like that? So, that is the world we live in. It is not waiting for us to figure it out. It is going elsewhere. And we will suffer those consequences, I believe, for a long time as well.
It's funny, Juliet, you mentioned, couldn't he just call Rex on the phone? Because one of the many White House complaints about Rex Tillerson is that he doesn't return phone calls well, and that apparently there was an effort
that may be
by
true.
People in the White House to reach him during this, and he was on a plane. And so maybe, maybe the president decided I can't get him on the phone, but if I tweet, then he and, hundreds of millions of other people will be forced to pay attention.
But has Tillerson blocked Trump on Twitter? That's the question.
I know, that's exactly right. Rich, I will say one thing. During the campaign, it was clear to me, it's amazing for an adult male, all of us are of a certain age, not to have any friends. It always sort of struck me with Trump that he had his family, but he didn't to have peers or people of equals around him. And I think that's true of the cabinet. There's no one you can really say that he likes a lot. And he's, in fact, at various moments undermined all of them, even his closest friends like Sessions.
Rich, if Rex Tillerson were to have to go, if his position became untenable, the name that people talk about as a replacement Secretary of State is Nikki Haley, the ambassador to the United Nations. I can't come up with any other names of people that Trump might nominate who would get confirmed. Is she the entirety of the shortlist?
No, Mike Pompeo, the CIA director. I'd actually give slightly higher chances. He could get confirmed. He apparently has a pretty good relationship with Trump, sees him every morning to do the national security briefing, and apparently has the ability, now that there could be an expiration date on this at any moment, but it's reported he has sort of the same ability that Mattis does of somehow telling Trump when he's wrong or delivering bad news without alienating him, at least not yet.
Finally, I want to talk quickly about private jets, because last Friday, President Trump fired Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price after Politico discovered that he'd been routinely traveling by private jet for official business, costing taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars over a period of just a few months. The New York Times reported that Trump spent about 2 hours berating Price in the Oval Office before firing him. And the scandal has brought scrutiny to private jet travel by at least four other cabinet secretaries, though so far they seem to have better explanations about special circumstances that warranted their travel by private jet. Do any of you have a sense of why this is the scandal that seems to be sticking in this bizarre administration? This actually seems like a pretty normal political scandal, and it forced Tom Price out. Why?
It's tangible. Because when we talk about the budgets, our health budgets, healthcare budgets, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars. Same thing with defense. But when you talk about the price of an airline ticket, and then you talk about the price of a private jet, that's something a little bit more tangible, and psychologically people can hang on to that. They can see that. They can make the comparison and contrast. So I think it really comes down to just psychological tangibility. And if it were up to me, I would say all elected officials would have to fly on Southwest. I think this would bring us a little closer to us, to the electeds, get them to the people.
If you've ever been on a private jet, also just understand how seductive this had to be for Tom Price. Because it is so much better just to be able to walk out of the tarmac and get on the darn plane. But this was abuse. It was corrupt. He was expendable. You know, it's not a power cabinet position like Secretary of State is. And he, you know, what was his primary responsibility getting Obamacare repeal through was a complete failure. So it made it easier to get rid of him quickly, as more so than some of these other characters.
Well, now we know that Rich has been on a private jet. I unfortunately have never been on a private jet. We're going to take a break. I am Josh Barrow. I've been talking with Vicky DeFrancesco Soto of the University of Texas, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Juliette Kayyem, former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. We'll be back with pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Vicky DeFrancesco Soto of the University of Texas. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And we're going to welcome a new guest now, Republican pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson. She's a columnist for the Washington Examiner and co-founder of Echelon Insights. She is also one half of the Pollsters podcast. And incidentally, they are going to join us in downtown Los Angeles next month, November 9th, for our live show. Yet another reason you should be sure to get your tickets soon at kcrw.com/LRCLive. Welcome, Kristen. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk with you about something that Matt Iglesias wrote a piece for Vox.com about this week, describing Trump as having a reverse Midas touch. He says that when Trump takes a public position on an issue, he's so unpopular that he makes the other side of the issue more popular. And he goes through polling about protests by NFL players that have become more popular since Trump denounced them, that public confidence in the media has risen since Trump's election, and that opposition to deporting unauthorized immigrants and support for a path to citizenship are both at record levels. Do you think this analysis is right, that Trump moves public opinion against him when he takes positions? And what are the implications for our politics?
I think when Donald Trump comes out and takes a position, it takes something that may have previously not been as partisan and makes it very partisan. And the simple math is that there are more Democrats than there are Republicans in America. Donald Trump's numbers among independents are not great. And so something like, for instance, trust in the media. You know, right before Election Day, trust in the media was low on many sides of the political spectrum. You know, Republicans have never been big fans of the media, but Democrats, no big fans of the media either. And they're believed, you know, that the media treated Hillary Clinton unfairly and in the coverage of the email story. But now that we're removed from that, when Donald Trump comes in and beats up on the media day in and day out, there is a sense of, well, he's on the other team and whatever he doesn't like, I should like. And so, you know, the math makes it so that when Donald Trump takes a position, yes, numbers among Republicans for whatever position it is that he has just taken go up. But at the same time, whatever that position is becomes much less popular with Democrats and among many of the independents who do not enjoy this president.
Vicky, how do you think these sort of culture wars that the president is picking on purpose are working out for him? Is he succeeding in advancing his political interests, or is this phenomenon actually making him worse off?
I think that it's an effective distractor. So in a sense, I see it like a little shiny ball that he's using to play with a kitten, because he has not had any legislative wins. I mean, we saw again the issue of healthcare fall completely flat on its face. Foreign policy-wise, where are we going? Taxes, there's supposedly a plan, but nothing really there. He campaigned and won the presidency on getting super tough on immigration and building a wall. And where is that toughness? Where is that wall? So to me, the culture wars are a win for him in that it takes the attention away from all of the stuff that he has not made good on in his campaign promises. In terms of the actual culture war in and of itself, I don't think it's good. I don't think we should be engaging in this when we have such momentous problems facing us right now.
Well, let's talk about immigration and public opinion on immigration. The president, when he announced the end of the DACA program — this is the program to protect unauthorized immigrants who arrived in the U.S. as children — he said it would end in March, and he said he wants to get some sort of deal to do a legislative fix through Congress by then. Kristen, when you look at polling on this, it shows a lot of public support for something like that, but I feel like we've been misled a lot by the polling on immigration over the last few years. What are the consequences for the president, either if he does make a deal with Democrats or if he fails to make a deal?
Well, I think it's important to understand the coalition that elected Donald Trump in the first place. And if you break it down, there's a fascinating study that looks at the five types of Trump voter. Within that coalition, you have business conservatives who are actually quite moderate on immigration. You have traditional conservatives. You have sort of your ethno-nationalist types. You have your pure populists and you have apathetic folks. If you talk about his positions on immigration, there's really two pieces of that coalition that care an awful lot about immigration, but it's not his whole coalition. And frankly, when you say Donald Trump supports X, that alone gets you an awfully long way with a lot of his voters who in one breath will tell you, no, I think that we absolutely need to do something about all of the folks who are here illegally. And you say, well, Donald Trump actually supports, you know, or has not taken action to repeal this Obama administration policy. Knowing that Donald Trump has not repealed it yet, how do you stand on it? And I've seen polling that shows significant majorities of Republicans will support what are thought of as progressive positions if they are told that Donald Trump also holds those positions. So I think in some ways, Donald Trump has quite a bit of latitude. Yes, if he takes positions that are more progressive on immigration, there will be quite a lot of noise from the Breitbart sort of portion of the party. And that is a portion of the party that is quite influential in things like primaries. But overall numbers among Republicans, I mean, this is Donald Trump's party. If he says that the sky is green, if he says that the sky is purple, an awful lot of Republicans will say, well, sure, the sky is green, the sky is purple.
Rich, what do you think?
I think there's a lot to that. On DACA specifically, you know, part of the point of it, besides just sure small d Democratic legitimacy, because DACA, in my view, was unconstitutional and illegal to begin with, was to get leverage, to get something legislatively on the enforcement agenda. And Trump seemed to immediately give that away after he said he was repealing DACA by expressing a desire just to get anything, just to codify it, no matter what the deal was. And behind the scenes, there's been an effort, as there often is on immigration, where he doesn't really understand necessarily the details of his own brief, to kind of pull him back. And I think we'll see a White House, you know, statement of principles on this that will set out a trade of some significant sort. Whether that would actually happen in Congress or not, I don't know.
Vicky, how motivating is this an issue for Hispanic voters in the U.S.? I feel like people typically, we talk about immigration as being a top issue for Hispanics, but obviously they care about a wide variety of issues. Mm-hmm. Is there a large voting bloc that is moved heavily by this issue on the pro-DACA side that will determine whether they turn out to vote or how they vote based on what happens here?
So I think we have two separate baskets. We have the motivating issue of immigration, and that hits a majority of the, at least the Mexican Hispanic population, very closely in terms of having somebody in your own family, in your own household of undocumented status. However, when you look at the data of Latino voters, we know that Latinos are the least likely to turn out and vote. They're the least likely to register and vote. Once registered, they're also the least likely to turn out and vote. So it is a motivating factor around the kitchen table, but we have yet to see the connect of getting folks out. Because if we would have seen anything, it would have been in this last election. And quite honestly, I am very disappointed in the Latino community, and I will put it on us. We should have stepped up and we should have gone to the polls, because Donald Trump told us who he was. He told us he wanted to cut back on immigration, and not just on immigration, but a number of other programs that help largely the Latino community. So we haven't seen, as much as we'd like to see, immigration act as a motivator, but I am going to be cautiously optimistic about the future, because I think DACA has hit a lot of these young, mobilized millennials, and they may be able to push forward, push those in their surroundings to get out and vote.
People argue about how to read the numbers, but it sort of looks like Trump did about as well with Hispanic voters as Mitt Romney did 4 years earlier. Were you surprised by that, Vicky? And what, given that, you know, as you noted, he launched his campaign with an attack on Mexicans, are you surprised that he sort of maintained the performance from 4 years earlier?
Well, Josh, so those are based on the exit polls. I lean more toward the Latino Decisions exit night polling. Let's split the difference and say that he did get low 20s. I don't believe that he got as high as Romney, but he did get 20% of the vote. And I think there are a couple of things. Let's not forget about the diversity of the Latino population. It is an umbrella term, but there are folks who differ by party. You know, here in Texas, outside of Florida, we have the largest Republican Latino population. We also have evangelical Latinos. They're not all Catholic. Abortion for many Latinos is a driving issue. We also have generation issue. So if you are a 10th generation Latino, things are going to affect you differently, especially in terms of immigration, if you are an immigrant yourself or you're the son of an immigrant. So I think that 20% highlighted that diversity within the Latino coalition in voting for Trump. And the Latinos that did vote for Trump were the same type of folks, non-Hispanic folks, who voted for Trump for his political stances. And I also believe for his aspirational stances that, you know, look at him. He's this successful, strong business guy. I aspire to be like him.
Finally, let's talk about upcoming elections. There's this Alabama special Senate race. Their general election will be in December. Kristen, obviously, Alabama is one of the most heavily Republican states in the country. But because Roy Moore is such a controversial figure, there's some talk about this being a competitive race. Do you think Democrats have any chance there?
I am hesitant to say that anything is impossible in politics these days, having been thoroughly chastened by the 2016 election. But I do think that it is very difficult for me to envision the Democrats winning. I believe in part because the Democratic candidate has views on issues like abortion that I do think are out of step with where most folks in Alabama are. Now, certainly Roy Moore is very outside the mainstream, not someone I am enthusiastic about having wearing the Republican label. But I still think that given the political makeup of Alabama, it is more likely than not that he is going to win. I think Democrats have a very slim chance of being able to pick up that seat, even if this is a year that is otherwise a wave election for Democrats.
Rich, where does Roy Moore and the need to defend him as a candidate and then presumably as a member of the Republican Senate conference put Republicans? You have a president who says lots of controversial things and people said, oh, how will Republicans defend this? And then they kept winning elections. But Roy Moore seems a little different to me in that he's sort of a culture warrior from 15 years ago or from 50 years ago. If the president has succeeded in finding the new wedge issues where Republicans get an advantage, Roy Moore is out there talking about the idea that the government should, you know, punish people for homosexuality. So the sort of things where if you pick a culture war fight, it feels like you're going to lose.
Right. Well, it just feels as though there's going to be less of a Todd Akin effect with Roy Moore, where every Republican had Todd Akin's statements hung around their necks. What year was that? Was that
2012.
And I think it's in part because the Trump statements are being hung around their neck. So whatever Ray Moore says, it just doesn't really rate. And this just feels like a race where Democrats could pile in, spend $30 million and make it a 4-point race, you know, a somewhat narrow loss. And they could spend nothing. It'll be a 5 or 6-point race. And I just think people are so partisan now. Everyone sort of has such a parliamentary mindset. What matters is whether it's the D or R behind the person's name. And as we learned, you know, just a year or so ago, you can be a congressional candidate and physically assault a reporter and still get elected.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Vicky DeFrancesco Soto, what's your rant?
So former Vice President Biden was on campus a couple of days ago, and in his talk, he mentioned how politics has gotten so mean and visceral, and I could not agree more. And I want a test. I want a test where you cannot say anything that you would not say if your mother were standing in the room, because you can disagree, but you can be agreeable in disagreeing.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Hypocrisy makes the world go around, but that doesn't make the spectacle of Lisa Bloom any less astonishing. The lawyer and erstwhile impassioned advocate for women victimized by sexual harassment is now flacking for Hollywood predator Harvey Weinstein, who happens to be making one of her books into a TV series. We all understand self-interest, but don't style yourself a women's advocate when you're really a mercenary willing to make excuses for the worst casting couch abuses.
Kristen Soltis Anderson, what do you want to rant about?
Well, mine is also in the men behaving badly toward women category. In upstate New York, you have Congresswoman Elise Stefanik. She is a Republican and the youngest woman ever elected to the U.S. Congress. And in a candidate forum earlier this week, when confronted by one of her Democratic challengers, a man named Steve Krieg, he said that she was a child and said, quote, "I have been accused of being sexist for calling Elise a little girl, and I probably deserve to be called sexist. I think most of us, if we admit it, have some of a sexist in us. I think this idea that, well, I can excuse my horrible behavior because I'm wearing a certain political jersey, or, well, everyone does it, is particularly grotesque in light of a variety of events, including those that Rich referenced.
Juliette Kayyem, what's on your mind?
So I'm going to cheat a little bit, and my rant is actually a rave. Times are really horrible. And when someone like me, who lives in the world of counterterrorism and destruction, thinks about what makes me hopeful, it is the tremendous capacity of individuals to help each other. If there's any silver lining out of what happened in Las Vegas, it is those stories of ordinary citizens becoming heroes to help strangers next to them. So there's plenty of rant to rant about, but I actually just want to leave with a rave to them, the heroes who did so much in Las Vegas.
For my rant, I just want to say that I love the Las Vegas Strip. It's not to everyone's taste, but to me, the Strip is a symbol of boundless American ambition. It says we're a society with enough resources that we can rebuild Venice or Paris or Lake Como in the middle of the desert. It says we're a society that has things so sufficiently together that we can have a designated place for being irresponsible, a place where what happens there stays there. And it's a place that says we're a society that likes our odds even when we probably shouldn't. Sunday's attack was an attack on this American institution, and it has the effect of terrorizing people who want to go somewhere fantastical and frivolous and not worry about things for a couple of days. So I urge you, if you like Las Vegas, go there. Try not to lose too much money, and don't let this shooter stop you from enjoying yourself and doing what you like to do. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, Juliette Kayyem, and Kristen Soltis Anderson. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.